You're listening to the Off Track podcast with Cornelius Lysett and Martin Dwyer.
Just to warn you, there are adult themes and some swearing in this podcast. If you're potentially offended by that, then please look elsewhere. There are plenty of other fine racing podcasts around, and you can sling your hook over there.
Welcome to the Off Track podcast with Martin Dwyer
and Cornelius Lysett.
Well, there's a combo to conjure with.
I know, a lot of people are surprised in racing at how well we get on and about our relationship, which I'm making it sound a bit weird, but I don't know why. Why are people so surprised?
I suppose I represent the media. You're a jockey. Once upon a time, jockeys and the media probably, you know, in the era of Piggott and Eddery and Willie Carson when he was a jockey, etc. I'm not sure the jockeys were mad about the media, to be honest.
Really? I just thought it was because you were a tough.
Well, you're a toughie.
No, I suppose we are on different sides of the fence, but we've always got on, haven't we? And genuinely, it does surprise people. We've got a lot in common.
Yeah, well, the great game of horse racing. I was trying, on the way here, I was trying to remember encountering you for the first time. And I can't remember an incident, but you were apprenticed, weren't you, to Ian Balding?
Yeah, well, obviously you were. I was apprenticed to Ian Balding. You were an owner at the time, part owner, and a couple of shares.
Friend
of the Baldings, and I remember I'd be working pretty hard, and see you waltzing the yard, looking very posh, and I used to think, who's this fella? Must be some lord or such like. And then I got to ride a few horses for you, didn't I? And then I think you were slagging me off one day, and then I got your phone number. I think that's how it started, wasn't it?
Yeah, I do remember the slagging off incident.
And that hasn't stopped.
It hasn't stopped ever since.
You are listening to Off Track with Martin Dwyer and Cornelius Lysett.
So what was the horse called that I rode for you? That was when you were slagging me off to Chris Connor.
Anstar. It was at Leicester.
When was a few years ago now?
Well, I just looked it up. I was going to go for about 1999. I suppose the biggest shock there is that Martin Dwyer was riding as a jockey before the turn of the century.
Jesus Christ, that makes us both feel old.
Yeah, half your opponents now weren't even born at the turn of the century. So, this podcast, was it your idea?
I don't know, I thought it was your idea.
All right, well, maybe it was both our ideas. Let's go for that, both our ideas. So what, it's to try and give a slightly different perspective, isn't it?
Yeah, I reckon we've both been in this game many years now, over 20. We've both got many shared experiences, and we probably look at it from a different angle. So let's get our heads together and see if we can come up with something and make it maybe a little bit informative.
And good to react to what's going on in the world, but also to reflect on some stories from yesteryear. And I'll tell you what, the big change to my mind, which you've ridden through the biggest change, I've worked through the biggest change to, in many ways, to racing in the modern era, was Sunday racing didn't used to really be big at all. And it's obviously gradually got bigger and bigger. So as a result, Saturday nights used to be the fun night of the week, didn't they?
Well, that's the thing. You know, I was thinking about it. I don't know whether the younger generation of jockeys today, I don't know why, it's maybe why some of them keep getting into so much trouble, because I don't think they have enough downtime, which, you know, in my early career, you know, as you say, we didn't race every Sunday and we had plenty of downtime. And a lot of that downtime was spent here in the Queens. We had some great parties. In
your office?
Yeah, one of the many offices. But it always sounded better, didn't it? I'll meet you in the office instead of I'll meet you in the pub.
And you actually used to live only a few hundred yards away from the Queen's Arms at East Garston. Give it a plug, your office. And I remember the menu at your... at the cottage where you lived, there was only one real choice on the menu, wasn't there?
That's a lie. It wasn't one choice. So I lived just down at my first ever house down on the corner there in East Garston, and you stayed over a few times. And I think one day we woke up on a Sunday with a hangover, and there wasn't much food in. So I gave you a pot noodle, and you were just astounded. You're like, "Oh my God, what's this ghastly stuff?" And then you loved it.
Pot noodles.
Yeah.
Oh, it was so straightforward, wasn't it? Pouring the
Is that you opening your wallet or what?
It was quite. I think you need your fan belt looking at sir or madam driving that car. Gosh, that is quite annoying.
Have you eaten a pot noodle since?
Not since you moved out of pot noodle. I called it Pot Noodle Cottage,
you
didn't
did,
I?
Actually, yeah. When I drove by earlier, brought back many memories. But they were great times, weren't they? This pub was heaving on a Saturday. All of racing fraternities used to come here. We used to have some great parties, many great stories. I don't know. Did a younger generation trainers jockey? They do enough of that now? Or?
Do they have as much fun? So I went to a race meeting the other day at Perth in Scotland, which, when I was quite a lot younger, was the best 3 days of the year, without question. And to be perfectly honest, one day did me perfectly well this year. It used to be racing in the afternoon, out on the town in the evening. You're one of the senior riders and you see the junior jockeys. Do you think they have as much fun?
Like, I don't know. That's the thing. I think there's a lot more pressure on them now, what with social media and all this other bollocks. And nobody seems to do anything without filming it or putting it somewhere. So,
imagine some of those Saturday nights in here, we won't name any names, but there were champion jockeys, there were well-known jockeys, there were well-known jump jockeys, there were well-known flat jockeys, there were senior jumps trainers, there were all sorts in there. Funny enough, there's a trainer in the pub today. I'm not going to name any names, but there's a trainer in the pub today, and I have such a clear recollection of last time I saw him in this pub. He came in quite late, I quite fancy myself on the old quiz machines. You were probably trying to have a fight with someone in the corner, but I was being a bit more cultured on the quiz machine. And do you remember those quiz machines? You sort of build up your potential winnings. So you started, you could win a pound, then you could win a fiver, then you got to a tenner. And I think the maximum was 20. So if you answered enough questions, you were suddenly earning in danger of winning, say, 20 quid. And so you were on £18. And this trainer, who I won't name, who's in the pub as we sit here now, ex-trainer actually, he came in one day, he lurched in with a former jump jockey, a former flat jockey, lurched in. They possibly had a couple elsewhere. They saw me at the machine and they came over and the trainer leant down and he turned it off at the mains. And so all my winnings are gone.
Questions did you get right to get to 20 quid?
I think I was sort of on the cusp of 20 quid. So I was probably on about 17 quid. So I probably answered about 30, to be fair.
I think that's a slight exaggeration. Not like you to exaggerate.
Those quiz machines, do you remember those quiz machines? Yeah. They used to be such good fun. The parties, I remember, endless parties here. I do remember another jockey who remained nameless, who I think was showing a bit too much interest in your girlfriend, and you took a bit of a view in here.
I remember that. Yeah.
And he remembers to this day. I always thought,
you interviewed him not long after, didn't you?
Well, I interviewed him subsequently.
What did he call me?
He called him.
What did he call me?
He called that shitbag Dwyer.
He wasn't saying that when I had him stuck to the wall in the toilets.
Because although some of you flat jockeys may not be very tall, that doesn't preclude you from being quite tough.
Well, I don't know about that. If you put on a good enough show, hopefully they'll back off.
Yeah, but we're talking about how, well, we weren't, but we're going to now, about how you sort of got into the whole thing. So you grew up in Liverpool.
Yeah.
So you should really have been playing football for Everton or indeed for another side in that area, but you didn't, and you ended up a jockey. How did that all happen?
I know, it's been well documented, hasn't it? I grew up on a council estate, fell in love with horses, just wanted to work with horses, and my dad was a big racing fan, wasn't he? You know my dad, you met him many times, and he wrote a letter to Ian Balding, and the rest is history, as they say. I mean, I know what you're coming up next. Your favourite story.
This is my favourite.
The hounds.
I was thinking earlier than that. When Ian Balding supposedly said to you, "What connection have you had? do you have with racing?"
That was one of you lot in the press. Somebody, I'd had a few rides, hadn't I? And somebody said with the name Dwyer, "Have you got links with racing? Have you got family in racing?" And I said,
thinking you were Irish.
Yeah, exactly. And I said, no, my dad had his bike nicked from outside the bookies once. That was as close as it got. But I thought you were going to start talking about the hounds. You still go on about
so,
that.
So it is a good story. You are going to tell it. So when you were at King's, so we're in the 1990s.
Yeah.
And the apprentice, in inverted commas, apprentice academy that Andrew Balding runs now was sort of going in those days as well, wasn't it? Probably not quite as big as nowadays.
I don't know. We had Ian. Ian was the original master. When I was there, it was 10, 12 apprentice jockeys.
Right. Name some other names.
Oh, Seamus O'Gorman, David Griffiths, who's training now, Francis Arrowsmith. He was from Liverpool as well. He rode Loxon, do you remember?
Yeah.
Well, won the Air Gold Cup on Loxon.
And she, because Willie Carson, who'd been riding her, but he had to go to Newbury that day for someone else, didn't he? For Sheikh Hamdan, probably.
Did he? I thought he was just, he was claiming off her, but, so it was a big thing back then to be an apprentice. Not like now, you didn't swan about with your wash bag and in and out of the races. You had to graft.
So did you not have a Mercedes in those days?
No, didn't. Had a push bike and a little clapped out old Peugeot.
Would it get you to the races?
Eventually, yeah.
Yeah.
Eventually.
Yeah.
I'm going back to the... Yeah, you want me to tell the story?
Yeah, yeah.
Going
so,
you do that, you... Don't you?
You professional broadcasters. what's the context of the dog story?
I'd left Merseyside, left the council estate, moved down to Berkshire, Royal Berkshire, where they all speak a bit like you. And it was just like an alien environment to me. And it was only the second weekend I was there, and Ian Balding said, right, you're going to come hunting with me on Sunday. I was like, shit, hunting? I haven't even got a red jacket. So I didn't have a clue what it meant, but it was drag hunting. So where the there's no foxes, but you lay a scent with a sock and a bit of rope and a big canister, well, I don't know what it was, but it stunk to high heaven.
Scent.
Someone said it was fox's piss, but how would you get piss out of a fox? How would you do that?
I think that's physically, you'd have to catch it first.
So anyway, he took me to, it was the back of Highclere Castle, it was stunning. And then he dropped
Downton
me
Abbey.
Off. Downton Abbey? Yeah, Downton Abbey. And with a piece of paper, it was a map, and this pissy sock and a canister full of stuff.
Were you on your own?
Yeah. And you set off like an hour before the hounds and the riders, and then he said, just run round, follow this map, lay the scent, and you'll be all right. So this would take you about 2 hours. And he dropped me there, and off you go. It started pissing down with rain. It was freezing cold. The map disintegrated in my hands. And I'm wandering round bloody the back of Highclere with holes in my trainers. And it was freezing, and I'm just wandering around. I got lost, didn't know what was happening. Next thing you know, I'm over this hill, and I'm looking up here. And all these fucking dogs come over the hill, and I'm like, Jesus Christ. And they're obviously running everywhere I'd been. And they're coming closer and closer. Fuck this. So I climbed up a tree, right? So I climbed up this tree, dropped this stuff at the bottom, and I'm sat on a branch, and they all come to the bottom of the tree, go mental, trying to get up at me. And I'm there shitting myself. And then they galloped over all the toffs, and Ian Balding and all the other toffs, all the fellas, and they're like, what are you doing up there, boy? And I went, fucking hell, the dogs are going to get me. And they're going, get down. I said, I'm not coming down till the dogs are gone. And then this other fella said to me, they're not dogs, boy. I thought, Jesus Christ, they don't even know what a dog is down here. Like, where I'm from, dog chase. You're climbing a garage roof or somewhere on the bus stop till they've gone. So I'm just stuck in this tree, and I'm thinking, this. Eventually, they went off, and I came down and walked home and met Ian Balding later on, and he took me back, and he was all right about it. But I rang my dad that night. I said, Dad, I don't think this place is for me. I said, they're all a bit nuts. They don't even know what a dog is down here. So, but I hated every minute of doing them drag hunts, but I had to do it every other weekend.
What, this trail?
Yeah, different places, but it was hard work. It really was, but that was my introduction to life in Royal Berkshire.
Funnily enough, I did an interview not long ago with Harry Skelton when he was champion jump jockey. And he was sitting underneath this picture of dogs. And I said, he said, everything okay? It was on Zoom. He said, everything okay? You know, can you see all sort of framed or whatever the professionals call it? And I said, yeah, the dogs were up above. I said, the dogs look good as well. And he said, a bit like your man, he said, they're not dogs, they're hounds.
So why did they get so offended, though? I mean, same thing, isn't it?
Well, I suppose, yeah. I suppose it's a bit like, do you like it when horses are called nags? You know, it's a bit dismissive,
but
I suppose.
That's derogatory, isn't it? But A hound is a dog, same thing. I don't know. Did you never go hunting?
No, absolutely not. Not really very horsey, not that sort of horsey.
So why did you get into racing that?
If I'm brutally honest, it was an attraction to my family that the racecourse bars stayed open all afternoon and ordinary pubs didn't. Because pubs only opened all day from the early to mid-1980s. So before that, yeah, they closed at 2:30, as plenty still do today, but you know, all pubs, 2:30, and they shut.
Right.
But racecourse bars stayed open all afternoon, and some in my family found that quite an attractive trait of going to the races. And they were into it as well.
So how did you get into broadcasting?
Like the sound of my own voice. I thought I'd get there before you said it.
Voice for radio. Yeah. But you went to Eton, didn't you?
Yeah.
What's the who's the trainer in Ireland?
Who does what?
Who the story about you?
Oh, oh right, well,
come on, tell us that story.
Edward O'Grady,
come on.
So Edward O'Grady, who was remains one of my absolute heroes, and Edward O'Grady, he's been training since the mid 70s, and I got to know him, and this was, in my early-ish working days. And I thought, it's Edward O'Grady. Gosh, this is quite exciting. And then he called me Eamon. So I got to know him a bit better, and he said, "Hi, Eamon," one day at Leopardstown. And I thought, I think he's just called me Eamon, but I'll let that go. You know, he's a hero of mine. And then he said it again. "Hi, Eamon, how are you doing?" This was at Aintree the second time. And I thought, I'm going to have to say something. So I said to him, "Actually, my name's not Edward, it's not Eamon, it's Cornelius." And he said, "Yeah, I know it's Cornelius." And I said, "Yeah, but you keep calling me Eamon." He said, "Knock, knock." And so I said rather warily, "Who's there?" He said, "Eamon." "Eamon who?" "Eamon Old Etonian," which he thought was absolutely... It's not that funny, is it? But he thought it was absolutely... And remains to this day, still thinking it's absolutely hilarious.
Somebody else told me that. You kept on quiet. Did you laugh at the time or did you get stroppy?
No, I didn't get stroppy. It was quite funny. In fact, it was more than quite funny. It was very funny. But...
when you went to Eton...
Yeah.
Did you have to attend lectures in... and how to communicate with common people like me?
If I said yes, did I do well? If I said no, are you impressed?
Go on, surprise me.
No. Do you know, being serious for a moment, not long after leaving Eton, because I'd been at boarding schools from the age of 8 to 17 and a half, all boys boarding schools, and two of them. And I was at somewhere called the National Broadcasting School, which is where you learnt to be a broadcaster. Looking at some of the broadcasters around today, it'd be quite useful if it was still around. But anyway, that's another story. And the National... I remember sitting in a classroom at the National Broadcasting School having a lecture on whatever, and suddenly realising that this was the first time since my primary school, so I was about 18 at the time, first time since I was at primary school that A, I'd sat in the same class as any women, and B, of anyone who didn't come from a similar type of background to me. So it was something to really embrace. And the BBC was a great organisation to work for, because although there is an element of rah-rah public schoolboys, but there's a big element that aren't. And so it was a great organisation to be involved in.
You are listening to Off Track with Martin Dwyer and Cornelius Lycett.
Andrew Balding and I, before Andrew took over from Ian, and Andrew and I used to say in the style of a old-fashioned newspaper billboard, when it used to say something like "War declared, shock," or something on billboards that you saw before you bought the evening paper, we used to say "Martin Dwyer has Group 1 ride, shock." That used to get you quite irritated.
Yeah, it did, you tossers.
Yeah.
You weren't laughing though at Nottingham. Remember that horse you... That horse you owned a share of.
Do you remember its name? I can remember.
It was called One-Eyed Willie because he had one eye.
It was called something party. Marching party?
Drummer party.
Drumming party.
They called him One-Eyed Willie in the yard.
Yeah, because he had, for one very good reason.
Yeah, I miss him. I rode him around Lingfield.
And which eye, you can work out, if you think of Lingfield, you can work out which eye he must have had missing.
I can't remember.
Because he must have not had his left eye, because at Lingfield, he didn't turn left, he went straight on, because that's all he could see.
Yeah.
Drumming Party, was it? Yeah. Oh, that was his name. Yeah. Yeah.
And you owned a share in him.
I owned a bit
Andrew
of him.
Andrew trained him. He ran off the bend with me at Lingfield, like you said, nearly went through the rail into the crowd. So next time out, I didn't ride him. I refused to ride him.
Mm. And Andrew's grandmother, who was a formidable lady called Mrs. Hastings, she was not impressed that you didn't that you wouldn't ride, because no. you were sort of stable jockey, weren't
yeah,
you?
Yeah, I was at the time. Yeah.
Priscilla Hastings, when the news was broken.
She was an Everton fan.
Was she?
Yes. Did well, you
she
not
came,
know
her? Her family came from Liverpool. Well, sort of.
Hastings bastard.
Yeah, really? But they, you know where? When I say her family came from Liverpool, sort of.
Yeah.
Knowsley Hall.
All right. Yeah. Well.
Which allows you, before we go on with Drumming Party, to tell the story about growing up on estates. Okay. Is that a true story? The one about Hugh and Hugo Palmer?
Yeah, well, yeah. Yeah, he wasn't happy about that, was he?
Go on, what's the story?
Somebody asked me, I was riding a few winners for Hugo at the time, and Hugo's a lovely guy, but he's like one of your lot, isn't he? And he wears, you know, orange cords and red socks and lots of tweed and speaks very well. But, you know, he can get a bit stroppy. And somebody said to me, are you getting really well with Hugo? And they were quite surprised. It was a journalist. And I said, thinking we were off the record, I said, well, yeah, me and Hugo, we've got a lot in common. And he was like, yeah, why? I said, well, we both grew up on big estates.
And funnily enough, did you not tell me years later that every time you get a ride for William Haggis, he makes you tell that story? Yeah, he loved that story, didn't he, Haggis?
Newmarket trainers enjoyed repeating it to Hugo, poking fun at him. Yeah. But no, it's again goes back to the class thing in racing, doesn't it? There is a bit of a gulf in class where, you know, us commoners get to meet you lot and mix with you. And
anyone listening to this think you're a chippy little fucker, but actually, you really are.
I'm just trying my best to mind you.
And you're succeeding. every single I've heard it so many times before. But going back to Drumming Party, so you'd said that you weren't going to ride Drumming Party because it had gone straight on rather than turning left as required at Lingfield, practically ended up in the crowd. So we went to Nottingham, and we thought we'd definitely win because we didn't. It was a straight mile at Nottingham, yeah. Wasn't it? And so what's the name of the apprentice who rode? Neil Chalmers. Neil Chalmers.
We used to call him Judith.
You called him what?
Judith.
Judith Chalmers. Did he have lots of holidays as well? No, that's a different story. He probably got a holiday after this. So Neil rode our horse, Drumming Party, which we fancied, and you rode something. I can't remember what yours was called, but you probably can't remember what yours was called. But that's
Dean Ivy trained him.
Yeah, that's unimportant as far as the story is concerned. So it's a straight mile or straight course, and we win the race. And in my opinion, we win fair and square. But then, and you are second. You're second, aren't you?
Yeah.
But it's such a ridiculous decision, ultimately, when we were thrown
rules
out in your favour. But
rules.
The stewards didn't have an inquiry until you went and said to them, "I think I might object." So they thought they better have a second look.
But I had to do my best for the owners that were employing me on the day, and that wasn't you.
Mm. And the funny thing about it was, it took ages to call the inquiry. And everyone else involved in Drumming Party had all gone and collected their winnings and had been paid out. But I stayed in the winner's enclosure to sort of glory in the fact that we'd won, and probably to take the piss out of you because we'd beaten you. So me and Andrew and Ian Kingsclear at the time had a good friend of yours, Chad. Real name Richard Phillips, but Chad, who was the travelling head man.
He was furious. He didn't speak to me for about 4 days.
But he and I were the only two who didn't collect.
No.
I think that's why.
We've been friends for years and he wouldn't speak to me. But your horse came past me with a wet sail, but because he's got one eye, he then hung in and ducked in across and hampered me quite severely. You know, I've seen my whole life flash before me. So I obviously had to say that in the stewards' room, and that's why they reversed the placings.
And I rang Andrew.
He wasn't happy either, was he?
Andrew wasn't there. He wasn't there. So I rang. I said, there is a chance I think we're going to lose this. Don't be ridiculous. I said, well, I think there is a chance. Dwyer's in full chatty mode. And he said, and that was goodness knows how many years ago now, but I can hear the words ringing in my ear now. If he gets this right race, tell him he's a disloyal little beep. beep. I think even the swear guide on this podcast won't allow me to say that.
But it came back to kick me in the arse because Andrew appealed the decision, so we had to go down to London for the appeal. And on the way, we travelled down together, and me and Andrew decided whoever won, if it stood, I'd have to buy lunch, and if he won it, he'd buy lunch. So anyway, it stood, and and the lunch cost me more than the prize money. So
did we not get it in the appeal?
No. You're never going to get it.
the chairman of the stewards, and these were the days when you couldn't do that. Imagine doing the story I'm about to tell you now. In nowadays, when the stewarding's always been serious and always been done well, but nowadays all these professional stewards are so terrified of losing their jobs that they can hardly smile at you, let alone talk to you. But the chairman of the stewards that day was in, and this was the old-fashioned days when they were probably, to use a Dwyerism, they were probably local toffs.
Dwyerism, is that a thing?
Well, it is now a Dwyerism. Yeah, it's a half brother to voyeurism. But your Dwyerism, he was probably a toff, and so I was so incensed by the decision that I rang, because it was just before Newmarket, one of the big meetings at Newmarket. So I rang an optician's in Newmarket High Street, and I booked him an appointment to have his eyes checked. and I said to them, I gave my name, and said, I'm terribly forgetful as well. If I give you my mobile, you wouldn't just ring me up on the morning and just remind me that I'm coming for an eye appointment, would you?
And you gave him his number.
I gave his number. Anyway, so the following Saturday at Newmarket, I see this guy, and he said to me, it was you! He said, I've been trying to work out who it was all fucking week, and it was definitely you, bastard. I remember being
you couldn't do that now, could you?
No, well, imagine if you did that, because the stewarding in those days was three local, I think they called them local stewards, what have been called rather rudely subsequently by various BHA inclined to use the expression now, amateur stewards. Mm. And to use the word amateur...
Well, they gave up their own free time to do it, didn't they?
But they were, technically, they were amateur, but they weren't amateur because they were non-professional.
No.
But they were amateur
they weren't paid.
Because they weren't being paid.
Yeah.
And that's quite an important thing about racing. There isn't the time to discuss this probably now, but the word amateur in society, amateur means you're not very good at something, you're amateur. But actually, amateur in racing, and I dare say in other sports as well, what it means is people who love it so much. I'm going to give you a Latin lesson. The word amateur comes from the Latin for I love. Amo amas amat, amamas amatis amant. I love, you love, he or she loves. We love, you plural love, they love. Amo amas amat, amamas amatis amant. So that word then becomes amateur, and you do it for the love of it.
Really?
But I think sometimes in
20...
You forgot all that. You forgot your Latin there, did you?
No, I forgot I asked.
I wish you hadn't. nowadays, I think that some people just forget that people... The guy called David Maxwell, who is a very successful businessman, and he rides his own horses in races, mainly amateur races, but also professional races over jumps. And to think that Sam Whaley Cohen, who won the Grand National.
Well, absolutely,
now, technically, he's a successful businessman. He loves it, and he's retired now, but he rode in races. And to call Sam Whaley Cohen or David Maxwell amateurs in the way I think that the British Horse Racing Authority nowadays quite likes people to think of that, of them.
He's not an amateur. He rides like he's a professional.
Well absolutely. Sam, and there are lots of. If you go to if you look at an amateur rider's race, obviously there are some people who aren't that good or just getting going. Mm. But there are plenty who look really decent, but don't want to turn professional for whatever reason. In Ireland, Patrick Mullins, who's the champion amateur, he's better than most professionals, especially with the practice. But it would mean he couldn't ride in bumper races or in pointed points.
No, it's a good point. So you've been a broadcaster, a journalist in racing for 25, 30 years now?
I've been a broadcaster for 41 years.
Yeah,
but racing since 19, 87.
And I suppose testament,
so that's 35
testament
years.
To that is how high you're held within racing circles in such high regard is that picture at Royal Ascot.
Oh, the picture at Royal Ascot. Now, here's the ultimate. Here is the ultimate. Oh, I'd forgotten about that picture. Here is the ultimate.
We have to explain, for, in case anybody's listening to this.
Yeah, I'm going to explain the ultimate insult. That in the pandemic Royal Ascot of 2021, was it? Well, it could have been 22. It could have been both, actually. It could have been both times. The jockeys, so what happened with the changing room, they had to expand the changing rooms enough space, didn't
they?
We
got changed in a bar down near the bandstand. That's where we were.
And near this bar, near the bandstand...
was a toilet, public toilet.
And you went in there in order to do whatever. And
to wash my goggles.
To wash your goggles, absolutely. That's another Dwyerism. I'm going to get onto the Oxford English Dictionary later on. This could be a new phrase for the Dwyerism. And so you're standing there doing your whatever in the gents. You look up and there is a photograph directly above
the urinals.
In front of the urinals. And what was the picture?
Picture of you.
Yeah, I know.
Picture of you in all your.
Top hat and tails?
You look very smart. And you know, they say sometimes, very much like the Mona Lisa, you know, a picture has to be in place. And
what you thought it was in the right place, didn't
it? The right place.
Yeah, a shit house next to the...
and you did not like that. I couldn't... Oh, great, I had to go and get my phone and take a picture of it.
Absolutely. You practically got arrested by the official who said you're not allowed to take your phone out. I've got an important...
took my phone into the toilet. Yeah, you didn't like that, did you? That was...
Well, no, it's a sort of...
It's a shame this is a podcast. It'd be great to get that picture out there.
Well, you know, technically we are being filmed. next time you go to Ascot, we're gonna start people trawling through the gents.
People are gonna go to Ascot this year. Normally, heading to the bandstand
and then trying to find the nearest loo.
Trying to find you.
But funnily enough, normally when people go
in a loo near you.
Well, at least that would be compared to some of the things you hear that you can find in racecourse loos. To be honest, that picture would be pretty harmless. But we've sort of gone quite a long way, haven't we? Have we rambled around the houses? We've gone about as quickly as some of the horses you ride these days.
They're getting slower these days.
You are listening to Off Track with Martin Dwyer and Cornelius Lysett.
Certainly, as a member of the media, I definitely used to sit there and think, and I remember the late Alan Lee, who was racing correspondent at the Times, we used to stand there, and it was our sort of ritual before a race, and say, what do we want to win this? Which basically means, what's the best story?
Who are you going to get the best?
Are you going to get the... And, you know, who's going to be the most fun story to tell? Mm. And the easiest story to tell, because they tend to go hand in hand. And you do sometimes look at some of the people involved and think, do I really want that horse to win? Because, God, the owner's boring, the trainer's boring, the jockey's boring. And then you say, gosh, that would be fantastic if... Well, and I suspect when people looked at the 1,000 guineas ahead of the race, people probably thought, oh, George Bowie, that would be good. A guy who's 30 years old, who's only in his... Is he in his second full season?
I think he had his first pattern winner the year before at that meeting, didn't he?
And everyone talks, obviously, is going to talk about the 1,000 guineas, but he was second in the Oaks, was it last year, I think?
Yeah, he was.
So he's...
He had a Breeders' Cup runner, didn't he?
He had a Breeders' Cup runner. But so people were thinking, you know, and he is a bit of a character because he's younger and fresher and different. And then that combined with James Doyle, who wears his heart on his sleeve and tends to say, when I say he says what he thinks, he says what he thinks, I'm not saying that he says the wrong things, because he doesn't say the wrong things, but he says some interesting things. And the owners, they're a syndicate, that's good and important these days as well.
Well, James, I think he was quite... you could see he was genuinely emotional. He's won quite a lot of big races around the world, and he's been incredibly successful.
But he hasn't got a British Classic until then, has he?
First Classic, and then he has his second Classic the next day.
Which is extraordinary, isn't it?
I mean, I remember a time when he talked about packing up. He actually took a plumbing course.
Yeah, absolutely.
I remember I got a lift with him to the races, and his car, we barely got to Windsor. and his car was falling apart, and he said he couldn't afford to fix it. So I rang a friend of mine who fixed it for him.
Really?
Yeah, and he paid it.
So
on
you
the
can
never,
the reflected
never.
Glory of James Doyle. Without you, he might have got to that point.
So effectively, really, I've got a hand in winning both guineas this year.
Yeah, and and are you going to mention it? You certainly are. Yeah, and maybe you ought to invoice James for that work that.
I don't think he paid for the car, so yeah, maybe. Yeah. But no, that it is. That's the good thing about racing.
I think that everyone needs to buy in, because the fact is, if the public wasn't there to support racing, to bet on racing and to go to the races and to support racing, then we wouldn't be able to compete for the prize money that everyone's competing for. So therefore, when you get an owner or a trainer or a jockey who is a bit standoffish, a bit reluctant, I think they have to think, actually, the public need to get to know a little bit about these guys, because actually, if they don't, then they're not going to continue to support it, in which case they won't continue to bet, there won't be so much money from there, they won't continue to go to the races, there won't be so much money from there, they won't continue to buy television subscriptions as well, and so again there won't be money around the place. Although, you know, you hear of a trainer's shy, an owner's shy, a jockey's shy, or doesn't like doing it or whatever, but I think they need to, I think they do need to buy into it. Because
I'm a bit shy. Maybe I should be a bit more outgoing.
Yeah, well, maybe you should be. There's another Dwyerism. But
what about our wonderful football team before we finish this podcast? What do we think? Are we hopeful of staying up? Because you were a QPR fan when I first met you.
Well, I'm a bit I'm a bit embarrassed because I'm a complete con man, really. If I bowl them up, Martin, you hit them. I'm a complete con man, really.
Yeah, we do know that.
I used to live in London, and I used to live within spitting distance of QPR, of Loftus Road.
We went, didn't we?
Yeah, long time ago now.
And then I converted, yeah.
And then, do you know, I was never a football fan. I was a fan of QPR because they were on the doorstep. And then there was a person who worked at the BBC, very good friend of mine, continues to be a good friend, and he said, why don't you come one time? And it was lower end Premier League stuff. I think he says it wasn't Bolton, but I think we were playing Bolton, and I think we were both safe 15th and 16th.
And it was rubbish.
And it was rubbish, yeah. According to him. But I went, and this is what I can't get over with football, is I don't really understand. I never sort of played properly or anything like that, even in the playground. But what I loved is that you go to the races. There are 7 races, and you get a big high, or hopefully get a high at the end of every race, maybe a couple of shocks during a race, during a jump race. But with the football, you sit at Goodison Park, and Mark Sharman, followed by Martin Dwyer, got me into following Everton. And you sit there, and over 90 minutes, you're up there, you're down there, you're up there, and you can be up there and down there within, at Goodison, within about 5 seconds. So I absolutely love it. I might say, this is before David Moyes came in, before Wayne Rooney. You said to me one time, they say there's a kid at the academy called Wayne Rooney.
A good friend of mine, Andy Holden, coached him. He told me this kid coming through, and he wasn't wrong. He was, you know, some player. I remember he scored against Arsenal when he was 17.
Yeah, and wasn't that? And do you remember there was a great goal against Leeds when he was, the skill he. It can't have been against Leeds because they wouldn't have been in the Premier League. But it was probably against. It's probably the Arsenal goal you're thinking of.
Yeah,
I've just proved what a con man I am.
Yeah.
But if I was a real con man, I wouldn't have corrected the fact that it couldn't have been Leeds.
Well, my uncle John, who lives a stone's throw away from Goodison, he still tells a story about he went to the match with you and you kept calling Tim Cahill Timothy.
No, that is an untrue story.
No, it's not.
There is another Dwyer in your family who's...
Go on, Timothy.
Anyway, amongst the many great things about your Uncle John is that he's got parking right outside his house, which is very, very useful if you don't fancy going all the way over to Sefton Park.
Yeah, but for a match day.
Yeah, well, let's keep our fingers crossed about Everton.
Yeah, let's hope we stay up.
Let's hope we do. I think Leeds could be in peril. Burnley aren't safe. 2 or 3 others could be dragged into it yet. So, come on, Frank.
Let's hope. Super Frank. Do you think we've got more chance of staying up or more chance of this podcast being successful?
The end. So this has been the Off Track Podcast with Martin Dwyer and
Cornelius Lysis.
Hopefully, we'll be back again to discuss further matters, reminisce further over both of our careers as riders. There's a whole cellar full of stories. And if you've enjoyed it, and if you fancy it, why don't you perhaps subscribe, perhaps like us as well, and we'll see you very soon.
You've been listening to Off Track with Martin Dwyer and Cornelius Lysett.